The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made it start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday afternoon California time space show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and very appropriate. We're going to Mars today, and Mars is still very, very bright and big in the sky, the southern sky. If you have not gone out yet to view it on this very close passage, shame on you. You should definitely get out there. You can see it really, really well with your regular eyes. You don't need binoculars or telescope unless you want to see a lot more detail. But we're going to be talking about certain aspects of Mars today. But first, a couple of tidbits of information. Today we're doing the 60-minute format program. So please pay attention to the clock and the time. And if you do have a phone question or an email question for us, make sure you ask it in time before the show ends, because again, we're doing the 60-minute formatted program. Our phone number, if you do want to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring and I'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. Email also is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post a question or comment on our blog, which is our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. We're the first show listed, and that also is our blog and archive page for this particular program. So open it up, and comments, just as if you were posting a comment on the blog, are down at the bottom. As soon as you post your comment or question, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up with our guest today, when appropriate on the program. So while you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, our fresh website newsletter, which is centered right on the homepage, is now up with all of the activities planned for this week and also the programs we have booked going into or nearing the end, I should say, of third quarter 2018. And do remember that everything we do is archived. Also remember we do have a store. If you're interested in Space Show logo wear, that's in the upper left menu under support. And then also there's Listen Live. That's an important button. Remember, this provides the instructions for how to listen to live shows, compressed MP3 archive shows, and podcasting shows, including Alexa via the TuneIn player. And you're welcome to share all that information, of course, and you'll find that also in that upper left menu. To me, the most important part is the supporting of the Space Show. So remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with one, giantleapfoundation.org. And we require and are really appreciative of your financial support for the Space Show. It does keep the program going. If you like what you hear and you like interacting with the guests via email or the toll-free line or even the blog from time to time, do support us, because we're unable to continue the show without your contributions and support. So remember, if you do pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift, because we are a 501c3. And if you're a California taxpayer, you get a tax deduction as well, because we are a public benefit corporation in California. Our parent, which is the public benefit corporation, the 501c3, is onegiantleapfoundation.org. Check it out for information. And, of course, if you want to email me, the best email address to use is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please do remember that we are trademarked and copyrighted, and you are absolutely free to download our programs and share them on the Internet. It is much easier to send people a URL rather than a full show. But do keep in mind there are a couple of rules about that. So one of them is don't edit our programs and put edits or anything else up on any website, including YouTube or your own personal website. Written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And then please don't do anything commercial with our programs. If you do require some special use with our programs, just email me and ask, and let's see if we can work it out. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our website pages, plus one GiantLeapFoundation.org website pages. So please make use of that information, and we certainly do appreciate that. We also have sponsors, so sponsors get their banner ad going across the homepage, and they can change that banner ad as often as they like. Please check it from time to time. We would not be doing the space show without the support of our sponsors, so see what they have to say underneath that rotating banner ad. On short programs such as today, we just simply list our sponsors and thank them. So we do thank Northrop Grumman, AIAA, our sponsors, Celestis, the Space Memorial Company is our sponsor, the Space Development Network is our sponsor, National Space Society, the Integrated Space System with the Space Plan is our sponsor, and then the Space Foundation. And we're deeply appreciative of their support. We hope all of you will click on their banner ads from time to time, and we hope that they find supporting the space show to their benefit as well. We would not be doing the show without the great support of our sponsors. Our guest today is Dr. Mackenzie Day, who is a planetary scientist who focuses on the behavior of terrestrial and extraterrestrial dunes. She's a recent member of the Mars Science Lab team and a newly minted assistant professor at UCLA. Dr. Day has used orbital and ground-based remote sensing to study dune fields all over Mars. On Earth, she studies how wind changes the landscape with an eye for understanding ancient deserts as well as modern ones. Using everything from rock hammers to wind tunnels, she continues to draw parallels between the patterns of wind-blown sand on Earth and Mars, and in the modern and the ancient time periods. Dr. Day's work came to my attention when I saw several articles starting to appear on something called ghost dunes on Mars, which I'd never heard of before. So I read about them and thought this would be an interesting topic for the space show, and I contacted Dr. Day, and here she is. Welcome to the space show, Dr. Day. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
What is a ghost dune, and why did we never hear of them before?
So a ghost dune is a term that comes from Earth, actually, and it's an interpretation of some unusual pits that we see. So to explain exactly what a ghost dune is, we need to back up just a little bit and talk about dunes in general. So we have dunes on Earth. They're primarily in coastal environments and in deserts, but there are also dunes all over the solar system. There are dunes on Venus. There are dunes on the moon Titan. There are dunes on Mars. And on Mars in particular, there are lots and lots of dunes all over the surface. And something that we discovered or that we identified in our recent work were two areas on Mars where there were these fields of pits. So rather than dunes, which are positive relief, which are piles of sand, we found a lot of pits in two areas that were dune-shaped. So it looked like a dune field from orbit, but the relief was wrong. They were holes in the ground instead of piles of sand. And so the term ghost dune comes from something very similar in Idaho. The Eastern Snake River Plain is a place where an ancient dune field was flooded with basalt, and that basalt covered the dunes to about halfway, and then all the sand from the dunes blew out. So what you're left with, and where the term ghost dune comes from, is a dune-shaped pit in the hardened lava from this partial burial of ancient dunes. So in the two places on Mars that we looked at, in Noctis Labyrinthus and in Hellas Basin, we found a series of pits that we interpret as ghost dunes, just like what we see in Idaho. So we think they were covered about halfway by ancient Martian lava, and then over time, the sands that were still loose from those ancient dunes blew away and left behind this field of dune-shaped holes in the ground. So that's what a ghost dune is.
So help me with this. Are all dunes sand dunes? Because I'm very familiar with sand dunes, having spent a lot of time on beaches and things like that, or in the desert. But can there be dunes that are not sand dunes?
For the most part, we're talking about sand dunes. Sand has a technical definition in geology, so sand is anything between 50 microns and 2 millimeters. So for the most part, things that are moving in wind are either dust or sand. You know, you can get really strong winds that'll move larger things, but when you're talking about a dune, most of the time it's sand.
And that's the same all through the solar system then, correct?
Yes.
Interesting. So Idaho is the only place where these ghost dunes have been found on Earth?
Idaho is the only other place that we know of, yes. There are a few other places on Earth where there's one in New Mexico, Ghost Ranch, New Mexico. There's another paper that came out on that area where an ancient dune was entirely covered, but we think it was entirely covered by water, and then material from the water rained down over the dune, so you preserve the actual dune shape in the rock record, which is very unusual, but it's not quite the same thing as a ghost dune. As far as having these dune-shaped pits, dune-shaped holes in the ground, Idaho and Mars are the only examples that we know of.
So the dune has a pile that stands up high on the ground, and then I guess over time it disappears and there's a hole in the ground. So where did it go?
So as the wind blows on these dunes that have been sort of partially buried, you know, all that sand is still loose. So it'll go downstream, it'll go downwind, and maybe there were ancient dunes that continued migrating downwind and eventually kind of disperse and blow away. You know, on Earth, what we see a lot of the time is a dune field will form, and then it'll migrate downwind, and it'll hit an obstacle. Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado is a great example of this. That dune field is up against a mountain range, so there's nowhere for it to go. The Kelso Dune Field is another example of this. So eventually the sand's kind of dispersed or hit an obstacle like that.
So if Mars, listen to me, if NASA sent a rover to the ghost, one of these two ghost dune areas to explore the ghost dunes, what would they find? Would they have to go down into the hole and then climb back out instead of climbing up a mountain or a hill? What would a rover do in that area?
So it would be very interesting to go send a rover to climb down into one of these dunes. If we take the Idaho example as a good analog, one of the things that makes these Martian ghost dunes really interesting is in Idaho, there's still some ancient sand from those dunes left in the edges of the pits. There's ancient strata. Strata is the term we use for the layers left behind by the dune, and it captures some information about the ancient direction of the dune, the ancient strength of the winds, and if there was any early life living in these dunes, that would be a good place to look for it. So if we were to send something to Mars to climb down into these pits and to take a look around, we can't see what's on the edge of these pits from orbit because it's going to be very small and the viewing geometry is not quite right. But if we sent a rover to take a look at what's there, it could be very interesting.
How deep are these pits typically?
They're about 6 meters deep on average, so 18 feet.
So that would be and the sides are pretty steep, like going into a crater.
So the sides are pretty steep. Not quite vertical, but close.
So
it would be a tricky thing for a rover to get into.
That's what I was going to say. It'd be a tricky rover maneuver and probably trickier to get out, right?
Yeah.
Any plans to put a rover into this area?
Not to my knowledge. There's a couple rovers coming up in the NASA planning pipeline. Mars 2020 just recently announced that they're having another landing site selection workshop this October. So I believe they're looking at three different potential landing sites, and they're planning to narrow it down a little bit more. But the location in Noctis Labyrinthus and Hellas Basin, those two areas are not currently being looked at for rover exploration. Noctis Labyrinthus is on the list of places being considered for human exploration by NASA, which is part of why it was brought to our attention in the first place.
You already have an initial email that has come into the program. So Tim is in Boston, and he said, I believe, although I'm not 100% sure, that I have read about the possibility of drones being flown on Mars. So wouldn't this be a ideal area to fly low-altitude drones over Mars with good cameras? Wouldn't they be able to see into these craters?
Thanks for your email, Tim. Yes, this would be a good candidate for drones, certainly. Anywhere that we can get to easily. You know, NASA is all about reducing the risk, and getting anything to Mars and exploring Mars is a huge endeavor that involves tons and tons of people and a lot of taxpayer dollars, so anything we can do to reduce risk, including sending drones instead of the entire rover, is great. I have heard about some drones being considered for different Mars missions. One of the things that's tricky about having drones on Mars is the atmosphere is so thin. So, you know, if you take a deep breath, you can feel the atmosphere on Earth, then if you think of what you'd have on Mars, it's only about 1% of what we're talking about here. So since drones, you know, as far as the propeller ones, the copters, are concerned, having that air difference is a bit of a problem.
I would think it would be. What are the likelihood of actually finding traces of past life? Is this a rich area for possible past life? I'm thinking of what they say about Mount Sharp and the strata that they're finding there with Curiosity, for example. Do these areas stack up to something like the different strata and the ancient lake beds in Mount Sharp?
So the environment, or the paleo environment, the ancient environment that Curiosity is looking at the base of Mount Sharp, is probably pretty different from what we're looking at in these ghost dune areas in Noctis Labyrinthus and in Hellas Basin. There's certainly going to be strata there, but it will, you know, it probably wasn't from a lake. Some of the lake bed strata that Curiosity's looked at are going to be very different. So it's, you know, it's a different environment, just like different environments occur on Earth. If you take a look at Earth and you look at ancient dunes, there are places where you can find signs of life in ancient dune strata on Earth. So it's not unheard of. It's certainly possible, and I think it's an important place to consider when we're trying to look at all the different possibilities where life might have been preserved on Mars.
Would it rate as a high-value target for looking at life, or it would be something less than high-value? I mean, I'm assuming they rate these places, right? As to what they may find for finding past life. So how would it stack up if they're in the rating system?
How would it stack up against other places? So that's a good question. You know, the idea of a rating system is not far off, but it's tricky because there are a lot of different things to consider that go into a mission. You know, there's the science and the value of the science. You want a high science return. But I mentioned risk, right? You want to minimize the risk to emissions. There's all sorts of engineering constraints that go into it as well. You know, you want something that's going to be safe to drive around, but also scientifically interesting. And the other thing to consider is that we base a lot of our understanding of what life might be like based on what we see on Earth. And just because dunes on Earth, you know, they happen in the desert, they may not be the best place to find a whole ton of life. But on Mars, you have some different problems to contend with. Mars has a lot of surface radiation and temperature extremes. You know, you can have 100-degree swings in a single day in temperature at the surface of Mars. And Earth doesn't have those problems to the same extent. So while dunes may not be a great place to look for life on Earth, and mind you, there is still life in dunes on Earth, on Mars, being inside a dune actually protects you from that radiation, and it protects you from those extreme temperature cycling events. So dunes might be better as far as potential astrobiological targets than some places that we're looking now, and certainly are something that we shouldn't discount and should keep in the running for places to consider.
I have another email that kind of wants to take you in a different direction, and mm-hmm. I'll go and ask it, but if it's not your field or it's not something you want to address for one reason or another, just feel free to say so. But Jack is in Tucson, and he said, I heard about a paper late last week that was released with a scientist from the University of Colorado in Boulder and the associate scientist from Northern Arizona State in Flagstaff talking about the fact that there would not be enough of certain kinds of particles or molecules left in the Martian atmosphere, so terraforming Mars would be an impossible task, and it was sort of a sarcastic article against Mr. Musk and his plans to go to Mars. Do you have any thoughts on, are there enough different particles in the Martian atmosphere to where it might be able to be terraformed? Are you familiar with the paper that I'm talking about?
I'm not sure I know exactly which paper you're talking about, but the idea that terraforming is difficult is certainly true. You know, doing anything on a planetary scale is crazy. It's huge. That doesn't mean it's impossible. But as far as particles in the atmosphere, you know, I mentioned before that the density of the atmosphere is only about 1% of what it is here. So we'd have to have a lot more air on Mars. We have to get a lot more air than is currently there. Some people have suggested melting the poles. You know, the polar caps on Mars are largely CO2. And so if you were to melt all the poles, I believe you something like double or triple the density of the atmosphere, which is a lot, but doesn't get you anywhere near having an atmosphere like you have today. So that doesn't mean there aren't other ways you could do that. And there's plenty of science fiction books out there that have suggested different strategies of, you know, varying levels of potentially viableness. But terraforming is certainly something that no one's going to be able to do anytime soon.
So the problem is that there's just not much of an atmosphere, or there's not much in that atmosphere, or is that the same thing?
Those are the same thing.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
There's not much of an atmosphere, and there's not much of a way to get more atmosphere.
I know Musk talked about whether, I'm assuming it was a serious suggestion about nuking the poles so they can melt the ice so you could get more warming stuff in the atmosphere, you know, to allow it to be terraformed. I'm not sure how far that suggestion would fly, but he did make that suggestion. So that's an idea to try to put more particles in the atmosphere so that it could be terraformed. I guess that's what his objective is, correct?
There's a lot of different aspects to terraforming. You know, having a thicker atmosphere solves a lot of your problems, but it doesn't solve all of them. You know, having a thicker atmosphere is nice, but if it doesn't have the right amount of oxygen, even if it's the right density, you can't breathe it. There's atmosphere problems, there's temperature problems, there's radiation problems. Mars is a fascinating, very interesting place that's like Earth in a lot of ways, but it's unlike Earth in enough ways that it would be very difficult to get to the point where you could have people just living on the surface.
In terms of all of this area of Mars to be explored, and I guess the probability of maybe finding past life or some life, and if we even include the announcement of this saltwater lake under the ice cap, how are you on humans going to Mars? Is this planetary protection? Should it keep humans from going? At least until there's been more exploration of Mars. I'm curious to know your thoughts on this.
Oh, I'm all for humans going to Mars. You know, we've done a lot of work as a society to further the cause of exploration and to further the research that's been done on Mars, and humans are sort of the next step. You know, NASA is currently working on a sample return mission, and I think that's sort of the major step in between the rovers that have done a lot of excellent research so far and the robotic exploration, and then getting actual humans there and having them explore the environments and the world on Mars. And I think there's a lot that we'll gain from that, and there's a lot of information that could be got about this alien planet, this next-door neighbor of ours, by sending humans there. You know, planetary protection is certainly something we should keep in mind. I think we should send humans to Mars, but I think we should do it carefully and, you know, be worried about contamination. And there are a lot of people working on that as well. But I think having that limit us and keep us from going there would be unfortunate.
Would you like to go to Mars to be a scientist walking around on the surface of Mars with a pickaxe and whatever tools are hanging off your belt?
I would love that. I would love to go to Mars. I would like a ticket back, but as long as I could come back, yes, I would. I would be on that volunteer list for sure.
Well, I guess, you know, that's a possibility down the road. Are there, you said there's dunes elsewhere, practically every place. Are there ghost dunes every place else too, like on Venus and the moons of other places and other rocky planets?
As far as we know, the only places where there are ghost dunes are Earth and Mars. That doesn't mean they might not exist elsewhere, but as far as the current state of research goes, just those two places.
Why? I mean, that would be an interesting question. Why only Earth and Mars? So obviously Earth and Mars have some connection together, right? It must have developed somehow closer than other planets developed.
Yeah, so there's sort of two potential explanations for the why only Earth and Mars question. You know, the simplest one is the data. You know, it's the scale of the ghost dunes that we've looked at, both on Earth and Mars, are, you know, sort of the 100-meter scale. They're, you know, the size of a football field, more or less. And when we're looking at Venus or we're looking at Titan or we're talking about some of these bodies that are less studied, we don't have the quality or the quantity of data that we do for Mars or for Earth. So, you know, with Google Earth and with Google Mars and with all these satellite images we have from both Earth and Mars, there's a lot of data. And you can look in really high detail at some really interesting things. And that's just not the case yet for a bunch of other bodies. So it would make sense that there would be ghost dunes on Venus. You know, it's in some ways very similar to Earth. And it would make sense that we would find ghost dunes potentially on other places as well. On Titan, Titan is a much colder place than Earth or Venus or Mars, but there are dunes there and there could be ghost dunes there. But we don't have the resolution of data to see this scale of a feature.
You can't see this through, say, a Hubble telescope picture, right? You have to. This is being done by stuff at Mars, correct?
Exactly.
I have another question, and Lisa is in Portland, Oregon, and she says this is probably dumb, but I'm not too knowledgeable about the surface conditions of things out there in space, but I do have an interest in it. Are there a possibility of dunes existing on the moon, and would there be ghost dunes?
Well, thanks, Lisa, and there's no such thing as a dumb question. Are there dunes on the moon, on our moon, on the moon, the capital moon? To my knowledge, there are no dunes on the moon of Earth, on our moon. Part of that is because the moon doesn't really have an atmosphere. You know, Mars has a very thin atmosphere, but it's definitely there, and it's definitely moving things around. Whereas the moon, the atmosphere is pretty much gone. So there's nothing, there's no wind to move the sand around. So no dunes on the moon, which means no ghost dunes as well.
You wouldn't say the regolith on the moon is sand, would you?
Some of it is. A lot of it's dust. But some the particle sizes of material on the moon span the whole range.
Is sand sand? Like, I guess the question is, if you had a handful of sand from dunes on Mars and a handful of sand on Earth, how different would the sand be?
Probably pretty similar. You know, there's a lot of variation in the sand on Earth. If you look at sand in Utah versus sand from coastal California versus sand from Hawaii, you know, those all look pretty different. And the Curiosity rover, a couple of years ago, went up to the Bagnall Dune Field, and it was the first encounter of a robotic explorer and an active dune on another planet. And we got up really close, and we took a picture of the sand from that dune, and it looks remarkably Earth-like. So, you know, I suspect that if you were to pick up a chunk of sand or a handful of sand on Mars, it would be very familiar.
So I have sort of a weird question for you, but when my kids were little and I used to drive them on trips all around the West, I probably did what I should not do, but I collected big plastic bags full of pink sand from the Pink Sand Park in Utah and white sand from New Mexico. So what makes the sand pink at this Pink Sand Park in southern Utah, and how does it get so white in New Mexico?
So what makes sand a particular color is the rock that it comes from. So in geology, we study rocks, and there are rocks and minerals. And if you think of a rock like a chocolate chip cookie, then the minerals are the ingredients that make up that chocolate chip cookie. So there are all sorts of different types of minerals. You know, quartz is a mineral, feldspar is a mineral. Every gem that you've ever heard of has a different mineral name. And those minerals all mix together to make up a particular rock, and the sand comes from the erosion of a particular rock. So White Sands, New Mexico, comes from the evaporating ancient lake that is upwind of that dune field, and that sourced area is full of gypsum, the mineral gypsum, which is a white calcium sulfate mineral. So that's why White Sands is all bright and white. In that particular region, the pink minerals are probably feldspar. A potassium feldspar is a very pink mineral. It's found in a lot of granites. So if your dune field is downwind of a granite, then odds are that a lot of the sand is coming from that granite host rock, and it's being eroded and it's being abraded into small pieces, and that sand transports and moves in the wind and bumps around and breaks down and eventually gets to the dune field, and that's that host mineral is what makes it pink.
So the natural sort of brown tan sand we find on beaches and throughout the desert in the Southwest, that's all from the rocks in the area or ancient lake beds that were there?
Exactly. All the rocks in the area. And if you go to the beach and you pick up a handful of sand and you look really, really closely, or you stick it under a microscope or a hand lens, you look really closely, oftentimes what looks brown from a foot or two away, from an inch or two away, is actually a rainbow of a whole bunch of different colors from a whole bunch of different types of rocks. So there's oftentimes a lot in just a handful of sand.
Interesting. And so if you did that with the sand on Mars, you'd see similar things then, right?
Yes. So a lot of Mars is basalt or lava rock. So if you were to look at a handful of sand on Mars, and there are actually pictures of this from those dune fields, the Bagnall Dunes that I mentioned, it looks a lot like sand in Hawaii. Hawaii is also obviously a lot of lava, so a lot of their sand comes from lava rocks. So the Hawaii sand and the Mars sand have a lot in common.
Another question came in for you from Paul, and listeners, if you can use the telephone, it is clearly preferred, as you all know. And that is 1-866-687-7223. So Paul is in upstate New York, and he said, it seems to me that with all of the sand and what's happening, if we could get astronauts onto the surface of Mars that really understood geology and the issues that you're talking about, we would learn much more about Mars and much faster than what we can do with rovers. The reason we don't do that has to be more than just the cost involved of humans and maybe the risk to humans, because I'm assuming a Mars flight would be riskier than just sending robots. Are there any other reasons why we're not seeing a rush to get astronauts onto Mars? It seems to me that's the best way to get real science real fast.
Well, thanks for your question, Paul. I totally agree. You know, if we were able to put humans on the ground on Mars, there was a lot of science we could do really fast. You know, rovers are great, and the capability of some of the rovers that we have on Mars now, you know, Opportunity has been there for almost 15 years. That that little machine is just trucking along, and MSL Curiosity has amazing capabilities, and Mars 2020 coming up has even more. So there's a lot that we can do with robotic exploration, but humans are really good at a couple of things that rovers aren't. Humans can do a lot of science fast, and humans are really good at decision-making and really good at deciding what's important and what's not. So I agree that if we were to get humans on Mars, that would be a really powerful way to get a lot of science very quickly. You say that there's not a push to get humans to Mars, and I would have to disagree. I think there is a rush to get humans to Mars, and I think that people are working on it, and there's a large contingent of people in NASA very interested in this and actively working on this. But NASA likes to do things right, and they like to do things right the first time. So rather than rush to have a mission that's not going to succeed, NASA is going to make sure to the best of its ability that we get those humans there and that we get them back and that we do it right. So that's going to take a little bit longer, but I think that is a smart decision, and I am excited to see how it turns out.
If we had worked on this 20 years ago, would we still be where we are today, or would we have resolved a lot of the issues, in your opinion, and been there with humans on Mars before now? Because maybe we didn't really start pushing 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm trying to think back. 20 years ago, I remember 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have cell phones. The amount of technological advancement that's occurred in the past 20 years is kind of phenomenal when you think about it. So, I bet you there were people 20 years ago who were thinking about this problem and starting to work on it. But the technological advancements that happened in the meantime, and, we've had multiple rovers land on Mars and explore and get a lot more information. And I think 20 years ago, we just weren't ready because we didn't know enough about Mars. And now we're finally to the point where we know enough about Mars. We know what we're getting into. We're ready to grow. And so now is the time to push for humans on Mars.
So I know, and I mentioned Gil before we started the show, but Viking was 1976 with the Label mm-hmm. Release experiment. And many believe, Gil and Pat Strapp, that it did detect signs of life, and they keep reanalyzing the data on Viking, which is amazing. I mean, how many times can you keep reanalyzing 1976 data? But so there has been a desire to do life detection experiments, and that's not necessarily the same as getting humans onto Mars. But there seems to be a lot of policy and politics and other things involved other than just doing things for pure science or pure curiosity reasons that get in the way and make timetables happen a lot slower. That's kind of my view from the outside looking in. But maybe that's part of the natural process. I don't know. But I think we could have done more. And when I hear you and others talk about what's there and the mysteries and what we need to do and what we could learn, it's very frustrating that it hasn't been done yet. And could it have been done 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and could it have been done safely with humans? I don't know. Maybe. We did get to the moon, although Mars is a whole lot riskier and more complex than the moon. But it is frustrating, and sometimes even knowing the correct answer is still frustrating. So a lot of us who are older clearly wanted answers by now, and it's frustrating that we're still waiting and the missions aren't there and we don't have those answers. But you raise great questions, and you seem to point us in the direction where if we could do A, B, and C, we could get these answers. So hurry up, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about the, and it's a combination of Congress and policymakers and other countries and their programs. And I mean, it's hard to lay it all on, one person's footsteps or something. But it seems to me that Mars could just really shake up the science community and what we do and how we see ourselves and how we care for Earth. And I mean, it would be revolutionary to get humans there and to start collecting real-time data from a human geologist saying, this rock looks interesting, let's go see what it is, where curiosity might not even see that rock.
It's true. It's true. There's a lot we could do with humans, and you bring up a good point. You know, fundamentally, NASA is government-funded, and the government is subject to Congress, and Congress is subject to the taxpayers, and so there's, you know, always an element of uncertainty in that. And I think the leadership of NASA does a really good job working with everyone in leadership and planning for that uncertainty. And you know, there are certainly pros at this, but yeah, there is an element of uncertainty. This it'll be interesting to see now that a couple of private companies are entering that space and looking towards Mars and putting their eyes in that direction, to see if they get there first.
Well, will they do?
Who knows?
And will they do science if they get there first? I don't know. I don't know if any of their crews are going to be geologists or planetary scientists, and they're going to go do scientific exploration. I mean, it's generally not a commercially driven field, as you know.
You'll have to get Mr. Musk on your show.
Well, he's been on, and so has Gwen, but that is, the next time they're on, I will ask that question if they plan on having scientists explore when and if they get to Mars. They mostly talk about space settlement, which is a sort of a different aspect of it all. I want to bring up this question that listener Kurt sent you in advance of the show, and I was hoping that Kurt might call in, but we haven't heard from him. His question is one, it refers to a 2013 geomorphology paper. 1 million cubic kilometers of fossil ice in Valles Marineris of a 3.5-year-old glacial land system along the Martian equator. What are your thoughts on it, and have you heard any independent analysis of their claims? Should the penetrating radars currently in orbit around Mars be able to test their claims? And on and on and on. Do you have any thoughts on this, and can you explain what he's after to the listeners?
Sure. So when we talk about humans on Mars and we talk about life on Mars, you know, this question of water is always a really important one. Because humans, to survive, need water, and life as we know it on Earth, in all of its forms, needs water in some form to survive. So people are very interested, scientists are very interested in where the water is on Mars, both for a astrobiology, you know, is there life on Mars context, and for keeping humans alive and exploring at the surface. So in a recent paper that you mentioned earlier, a group identified this potentially what they've interpreted as a liquid water lake underneath the South Polar Cap on Mars. And that's a really big deal, because liquid water isn't stable at the surface of Mars. You know, the temperatures are okay for it sometimes, but the pressure is too low. So it'll immediately evaporate, and it doesn't stay liquid at the surface. The polar caps have solid ice in them, so you can have ice and you can have vapor, but you can't have liquid water. The paper that Kirk is referring to, the 2013 geomorphology paper, talks about glacier deposits. So they're interpreting these ancient glaciers in Valles Marineris, which is the biggest canyon on Mars. It's the biggest canyon in the solar system, in fact. And these ancient glaciers might have some fossil ice in them. And so fossil ice would be ice that's very old, that's still there, but that's under the rock and remnant from these very old glaciers. So the question is, is that ice still there? Can we identify that it's still there? And if it's still there, can we use it? You know, the number that they cite is huge. It's a lot of ice. And one of the ways to look for it is with MARSIS and SHIRAD. These are two radar instruments that Kirk mentioned in his email. And radar is really good at looking in the subsurface. So we can look below the surface. We've got all these cameras on these orbiters to see visually what's at the surface, but if we want to go deeper, that's actually really hard. So one way to do it is with radar. But the issue with radar is the vertical resolution is not very fine. So it's really good at looking subsurface, and it's really good at giving you a big picture, but how close is that ice to the surface? If it's 100 feet down, that's less helpful to astronauts than if it's right below the surface. So trying to figure out where that ice is if it's still there. It's a similar problem to looking at the lake in that South Polar Cap. How far down is it? How can we get to it? How can we use that resource to look for life or to help out humans once they're there?
And knowing how to do that is an unknown at this time, right?
That's right.
So
there are a lot of people working on it, but no particular way has been decided.
So the lake that you referenced is supposed to be salt water, not fresh water. So how does it get to be salt water?
So here, salt water could mean a lot of different things. You know, it could mean salt water like the oceans on Earth are salt water, or it could mean salt water with a different type of salt or a different amount of salt. The lake that they're looking at is right at the base of the polar cap. So it's right where the ice and the rock touch each other. So odds are that that water is probably very old, and it's probably been in contact with that rock for a long time. So if you think of lakes on Earth or very old, you know, even puddles of water in your backyard that are sitting on rocks or things like that, those are not exactly fresh water. So there's probably some amount of saltiness in them that they're referring to in this case as a saltwater lake or a briny lake.
So not necessarily like the Pacific Ocean, but...
not necessarily.
You have a caller that I hope is still on hold. Let's see who your caller is. Hello, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you and where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hey, David. This is Kirk Hilliard calling from Central Virginia and calling in just at the right time, I guess.
That's
calling
right.
In blind.
I just kind of read your note because Dr. Day had sent it to me. So we sort of have been talking about it, but I did not do it your note justice. So you may have more to elaborate and ask our guests. So go ahead.
Okay, yeah, out here in Central Virginia rural area, I'm not getting enough connectivity to listen to the show live, but hearing it when I was on hold, it sounded like she was addressing it pretty well. And one point she made is that this geomorphology paper does talk about a whole lot of ice. I mean, it's really on the order of 1 million cubic kilometers of ice. That's like 40% of the Greenland ice sheet. That's a lot of water that's down pretty close to the equator. And given the significance of that, Dr. Day, were you aware of this before? Because I'm kind of surprised how little publicity I'd seen surrounded this paper.
So it's from 2013, so it was a few years ago. And thanks for calling in, Kirk. I have heard of this before. There's been a lot of talk of glaciation on Mars. I'm in Valles Marineris, and particularly along the dichotomy boundary. So if you look at a topographic map of Mars, the northern half of Mars is very low elevation, and the southern half of Mars is very high elevation. So there's this gap, and a lot of people have looked at glaciation across that gap and sort of low-latitude, mid-latitude, high-latitude glaciers and where ice was and might still be on Mars. And it's still an open question. You know, we don't know what the environment and what the climate was like on Mars 2, 3, 4 billion years ago, and using the surface geology and the geomorphology to try and figure that out is still very much an open problem.
So your sense is that this is by no means a fringe paper, because I think the authors, while they have published a number of other papers about geomorphology findings on Mars, they are predominantly Earth-based geologists, aren't primarily planetary scientists. Now, sometimes when you have people publishing a little bit out of their field, I think sometimes their papers aren't taken quite as seriously. And I'd almost wondered if this was almost news that was too good to be true, and that was supported by the fact that it wasn't receiving so much publicity. But is it more of an issue that there's just really we're not in a position to be able to test their hypotheses yet?
Well, I think this is a perfectly legitimate paper, and, you know, I read through most of it, and they present some really good points, and, you know, it's very difficult to prove anything when it comes to Mars definitively, and hopefully as time goes on and we get more instruments on Mars with higher and higher precision, we'll start to collapse our interpretations all into the same thing and verify some of these interpretations or answer some open questions, but, no, I think this is an important issue of potential glaciation in Valles Marineris and in other areas that we should keep in mind going forward.
Okay, I'll go ahead and put up a note on the blog page for this show, giving a link to that paper. And the audience may be quite interested in this. It's a very long paper, and part of it goes into a lot of technical detail, but it also has, it has good summaries. It's got diagrams. I thought they did a very good job explaining the reasoning they have for believing that there's this remnant glacial ice there. And listeners might quite enjoy that.
How did you How did you find the paper? What led you to it?
I think this was just a general, this was a couple of years ago, and I'll have to look back through the notes. I know I had called in when Dr. Zubrin was on the show a while ago, and this a year or two ago, and asked if he'd heard of it. He hadn't, but was intrigued.
He's on again tomorrow night, by the way.
I just noticed that as I was having to go get online to find your phone number, and I just noticed that as well, yeah. It was probably just a general search on issues with water on Mars, and so it is interesting because I'm not sure how I ran across it, and I've seen very few references to it since then, so I'm not quite sure what did lead me there.
Okay, thank you very much, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Okay, I look forward to listening to this when it comes up on podcast.
Thank you.
Bye.
Listeners, the line is available, and there is still time, though remember we're on the hour format, 1-866-687-7223. Dr. Dabb, a kind of interesting, unusual question. In fact, we've had a couple of them, I think. This is from Jake, and Jake is in Albuquerque. And Jake said, I'm studying geology as my undergraduate science choice in university here in Albuquerque. And while my geology textbook is fairly current, it's not totally brand new, but I suspect for basic geology, the textbooks have probably not changed or evolved much over the past 20 or 30 years. I'm wondering if somebody wrote a basic 101 introductory level textbook for Mars geology, how quickly that textbook might evolve or change based on, first, continued rover exploration missions, or, two, actually getting humans there with human input into the geology of Mars. Do you think that the basic Mars 101 geology textbook would undergo rapid changes if we sped up our Mars exploration rover program or actually got humans there to start doing geology and science on Mars through the human perspective?
Ooh, thanks, Jake. That's a great question. I think as soon as we get humans to Mars, any 101 geology textbook is going to need a huge update. And that's certainly true. And in fact, if you go back, so I'm a sedimentologist, and so there are a few books or a few review articles that kind of take a holistic look at sedimentology on Mars. There's one from 2000, there's one from, I think there's one around 2008, and there's one in 2012. And if you look at those, they more or less correspond with new missions, with big missions that are looking at sedimentology. And I think what those show you is that every time, you know, a mission is a big deal, and we get a lot of science out of a mission really fast. And every time that happens, it's so much more information that works together with all the information that we already have. And going from another rover to humans is just so much more capability, like we've already talked about, that I think that would be a huge step up, and I think you would need a new textbook at that point. I mean, that's when we get humans to Mars, that's history right there. So I think we're good for a little while, but as soon as we get 2020 on the ground, and then once we get humans on the ground, you know, be ready for your textbooks to start turning over.
So my advice would be to people who have Mars basic textbooks, hold on to them. They'll probably be collector's items, and and get the first edition of a textbook based on human exploration on Mars. That probably is going to be a great classic, I would imagine, based on on how this information is changing and the pace at which it changes.
I will say, if I may, NASA does a really good job of televising all of the big events that happen in NASA. You know, every time there's a launch or a landing, NASA TV will publicize it, and you can watch it live, and they'll walk you through what's going on. And they do a really good job with that. You know, I remember watching the feed of MSL landing and watching the control room and watching all the people who were so excited when Curiosity made a successful landing. And that's, you know, it's a big part of history, and especially when we're talking about humans on Mars. In this day and age, being part of that and watching it is really easy to do. So I'd encourage that for anyone interested in space.
You're getting some strange questions, Dr. Day. So here's another one. So Jane is, and I know we're coming short of time. Jane is in Chicago, and she said, David, I looked up the UCLA faculty page for Dr. Day, and she looks very, very young. So here's my question to you, Dr. Day. Were you at all around during the Apollo period? Do you actually believe we went to the moon with humans? And does returning to the moon have as much interest for you as getting to Mars?
Hi, Jane. Thanks for calling. Let's see. To have been around in the Apollo area, see, we landed on the moon in 1969. So if I were alive when we landed on the moon, I would have to be, help me out here, 50?
Yeah.
Ish. Well, obviously, if you've seen my picture, that's not true. So no, I was not around in the Apollo era. But we certainly landed on the moon, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of scientists who will tell you that. And there is a lot of scientists that makes it, there's a lot of science that we got out from landing on the moon that should leave no doubt in anyone's mind that yes, of course we landed on the moon. We landed on the moon. We got groundbreaking, life-changing, whole fields of science out of that that have been applied to other planets. And there is a lot of planetary science that is based on some of the results and some of the samples from the moon. And you know we landed on the moon because if you look at the chemistry of the lunar samples, they're not like anything that you see on Earth. So, yes, we landed on the moon, and there is lots of amazing science that we got out of that great achievement of human engineering and bravery. I think it is certainly worth going back to the moon, and I know there are lots of groups that are working on that. My personal expertise is more aligned with Mars. Mars is a lot more like Earth in its geology and its geomorphology. It's got canyons, it's got potentially glaciers and mountains and volcanoes, and the moon doesn't have that. The moon is a very different environment. So Mars is my passion and what I'm really interested in. But certainly there is a lot of interesting science that we could still get from the moon if we were to go back there again.
We're planning a Europa Clipper mission. Does going to Europa grab you in any way, or would you rather see the funds be committed to Mars?
Oh, Europa is so cool. I mean, I would love to see funding for missions to all the different planetary bodies that we can reach, but I like to be a realist, and I'm very excited about the Europa Clipper mission, you know. As interesting as Mars is, you know, Mars is a fascinating place and has a lot of similarities with Earth. Europa is very different. Europa is one of these ocean worlds that's fascinating and very different from what we see on Mars and what we see on Earth. And I think there's a lot of science to be done there and a lot of really interesting, potentially life-related things there. So getting to Europa is going to be another very exciting endeavor in planetary exploration. Very different constraint, very different engineering problems than Mars, but people are working on it, that's for sure.
Does the UCLA Planetary Department have a focus on Mars or Europa, or is it a focus on everything in general? Like, does it have a special interest on one location, such as Mars?
Nope. So the department that I'm in, the Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences, has a lot of different faculty who have a lot of different interests, and one of the reasons I fit really well there is because my interests are split between Earth and planetary science. So I like to bring what we know about Earth to other planets and make sure that our interpretations of other planets are grounded in a really solid understanding of terrestrial or Earth geology. But in my department, there are people working on Europa. There are people working on Ceres, the small body. There are people working on Vesta, working on Earth and Venus and all sorts of different planets, exoplanets, small asteroids, small bodies, moons. There's a little bit of everything. It's a very broad, diverse department with a lot of interest in planetary and Earth science. So it's a great place for me to be. I'm very excited to be there.
We are at the top of the hour. Did we forget to talk about anything with Ghost Dunes or any other topics in your interest that we should have talked to you about, and any concluding comments or takeaways that you'd like to leave with us for today?
You know, I think we've covered a lot of ground here and a lot of really good questions from your listeners. And I'd say, you know, thank you for having me on the show. This has been a real treat, and I hope everyone keeps an eye on what's going on Mars, and hopefully we'll all be there to see humans land not too far away.
We appreciate your being here, and hopefully we can talk to you again down the road about Mars and other things going on in the solar system. Just the volcanoes going off in Hawaii and all the earthquakes I see happening around that. I'm fascinated by all that activity. So I have an earthquake app on my iPhone, and I'm getting like 20 alerts an hour from Hawaii and the Pacific area alone around where the volcano is. It's amazing to me, the activity of the Earth, and most of it isn't even being reported, I guess. So there's a lot going on here that probably happened on Mars a long, long time ago. So we thank you very much for being here. Hope to talk to you again down the road. Listeners, that is it for today, and come back tomorrow night. Bob Zubrin is back with us, and he primarily wants to talk about the Mars Society Conference in 2 weeks, but he is available for questions you might have for him, including his paper at Centauri Dreams on the dipole engine concept, rocket motor concept for propulsion. Everybody have a great week. We thank Dr. Day for being with us, and all of you who emailed us, and for Kurt's phone call. Keep looking up and make it a good, safe week. Goodbye from Dr. Day, David, and the Space Show.